This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Kill the Farm Boy, The Tales of Pell by Delilah S. Dawson and Kevin Hearn. Read for you by Luke Daniels. To all the mouthy goats out there, you're extraordinary. Trust us, we're writers. 1. In a foreboding tower, glowing with portent, or possibly pollen. Many moons ago, in a principality far, far away, a hirsute lady slept in a tower that was covered in thorns. In general, such an occurrence would not be considered worthy of note, for people slept in towers all the time, regardless of their current level of hair growth. But in this particular case, it was not just the lady who slept. Almost everyone in the castle was magically sleeping, including the Earl and Countess and even Oxnard the guard, sitting in the kitchen with his mouth open, eyes closed in bliss, forever eating a piece of cherry pie, thereby creating with each passing minute a new world record for extended pie eating. Dogs, horses, children, knights, the bathing woman with soap in her eyes, everyone stood or sat or lay as if frozen in mid-action, even when such actions were wildly inopportune. The sole exception to the rule was the owner of a lonesome, warbling voice that could be heard every so often singing songs about remembered conversations and how awfully quiet sleeping people tended to be, and how if someone didn't arrive with groceries soon, a certain someone would go to sleep and wake up dead because Oxnard the guard didn't have the keys to the tower door on him and they were nowhere to be found, plus the door itself had turned into solid stone, and all the other exits and castle walls were likewise impossible to manage. And food was getting rather scarce, especially cheese. There was little else of note besides the roses peeping out from the thick blanket of vines. The plush fuchsia blossoms were as beautiful as the thorns were sharp, and there was an abundance of them both, together with a cloying scent of otter and some dizzy, happy bees that seemed to possess a particularly charmed ability to not succumb to sleep and thereby patter to the ground like furry grapes. There was also an abundance of portent, swaddled about the place. Oodles of it, a surfeit even. Something would go down there soon. But for now, the lady slept. And drooled a little, probably. 2. In a squalid barnyard in Borix's. Redolent of feces and angst. The very worst part about drudgery, Worstley thought, was all the blasted drudging one had to do. Nothing joyful or fun or frolicsome around the corner for a lowly farm boy like him to look forward to. Just more drudgery of a mind-sapping, soul-sucking nature, and on a good day, no cause for involuntary up-chuckery. At least he'd become somewhat accustomed to cleaning up the barnyard after his older brother, Bestley, had been stabbed in the heart by Lord Urgot for being too handsome. Some said barnyard duties were a step up from scrubbing the chimney, but Worstley wasn't so sure. It had been almost 9 months since he'd last vomited at the smell of assorted animal dung, but it was a constant struggle. It was still his least favorite chore. And he had to do it every other day. Walk out there with a shovel and a sack among the goats and the pigs and the chickens and those dratty geese that goosed him whenever they could, and scoop up whatever foul turds they had excreted since the last time he'd cleaned up. And after that, the stables awaited the same routine. Only then could he have a sad waffle with no syrup on it for breakfast. He didn't think his mother made them properly. Rumor in the village had it that waffles weren't supposed to be gray. Like most cheerless days in Borix's, the sky was the color of his mother's waffles. Worstley sighed at the clouds, exasperated. Would it
kill you to let the sun shine through every once in a while?" he said.
The demon geese honked at the sound of his voice and waddled his way, hissing, wings extended in a threat display. Worsley raised his shovel in front of him protectively.
"Go on now! Shoo!" he said.
As he fenced with their snapping beaks for a few seconds, he couldn't help muttering,
"There's gotta be a better way to live than this."
Had he been in a musical, he thought, right then would have been the perfect time to sing a sad song about his woeful lot in life while emphasizing his eternal optimism and plucky heart. Although he'd been born in this very barnyard, right there by the bucket of lumpy slop, he'd always felt that he was meant for greater things, for some important purpose in the larger world. But there wasn't so much as a gap-toothed troubadour around to strike an obliging opening chord rhapsodizing about his shining future.
Lord Urgot had hanged them all for singing a little ditty about his pokey short sword on his wedding day.
The geese fended off. Worsley checked the position of the black billy goat that occasionally found it amusing to ram him from the blind side and bleat a laugh as he clutched his back and winced. So far the goat was staying still. Gus was his name, but he was watching Worsley carefully from the other side of the barnyard near the fence. Or at least Worsley thought Gus was watching him. It was hard to tell. The goat's eyes never seemed to point in the same direction.
"Don't even think it, Gus,"
Worsley called. Gus bleated, lifted his tail, and ejected a fresh pile of pellets out his backside.
"Oh, great. Why do people think animals are cute?"
Worsley wondered aloud.
"They're just nasty." "Ah, you got it easy, kid,"
a voice called from the fence to the right of the billy goat. Worsley's eyes slid in that direction and spied a diminutive form perched on a post.
"Goats ain't nothing. You want a dangerous pile of poop? Wait until you get a loaded dragon dump. It's hot and sulfurous and it'll burn the hairs right out of your nose." "Who are you?"
Worsley asked. "Better yet, what are you?"
"Come here, kid. We gotta talk."
Keeping a wary eye out for attacks from geese and goat, Worsley drew closer to the fence to get a better look at the speaker. Whoever she was, she had a set of double wings like a dragonfly's branching from her back, thin and translucent and veined with iridescent colors. They were the most beautiful things Worsley had ever seen. But the owner of said wings wasn't precisely the image of a proper fairy. A rather large mole, with three stiff and proud hairs sprouting from it, was rooted on the side of her left nostril. She had two black holes where teeth should have been, and the three remaining molars were capped with gold. A single eyebrow, not unlike a furry caterpillar, wriggled about on her forehead. Worsley would have expected a glittering dress, dainty as a flower. But such was not in the offing. She wore a shirt that looked more like a used handkerchief, possibly swiped from someone with the plague. Her dull red pants ballooned over the thighs, with the right leg bunched at the knee, revealing one blue threadbare sock. Her left pants leg fell to her ankle, but that foot was sadly sockless. Dirt rimmed her toenails, and she radiated a powerful funk that might have been fungal in origin. In short, she resembled a fairy about as much as Worsley looked like a prince.
"Are you all right?"
Worsley said.
"Of course I am. I mean, apart from it being too blasted early, I'm fine."
She belched robustly.
"Ah, that's better."
Worsley blinked.
"Right. It's just that you don't look like what? You'd better not say a fairy, kid,"
she said, pointing a warning finger at him. The finger appeared to have a booger affixed to the tip.
"I'm a pixie. Name Staff."
"Staff?"
"That's what I said. I'm here to change your life, so we should probably get on with it so I can do something more productive with my day than talking to some scrawny cheese hole."
Worsley took a step back and looked around suspicious. He'd always dreamed of seeing a fairy, but never one that smelled quite so terrible.
"Is this a joke? You can't be a pixie."
Staff blanched and looked over her shoulder to make sure she still had wings. The motion made her wobble unsteadily on the fence post.
"Wings are still there. I'm a pixie. What the fuck else would I be? A bogey?
She waggled her booger-tipped finger threateningly at him and cackled.
Are you drunk? Not as much as I'd like to be. Now look, kid, I'm here to tell you something important. The good news and the bad news is that you're the chosen one. You have a destiny, and I'm here to bless you with it. Or curse you, whatever. Anoint you, let's say.
This has definitely got to be a joke. Who put you up to this? The pixie rolled her eyes.
Ugh, enough with that, all right? Nobody cares enough to play a joke on you, farm boy. This is destiny. All genuine and bona fide. What's so hard to believe?
I thought pixies were supposed to be named Butter Blossom or something, and they're, like, I don't know, clean? Staff's eyes bulged, and she held up her boogery index finger to scold worstly.
First, Butter Blossom is a no-talent harpy who invades homes at night and eats little kids' pet hamsters.
She held up another finger.
Second, clean people have no fun, and they only bathe because they can't think of anything better to do. But me, I've seen some right bloody business, and I know things.
Worsley shrugged and sighed and shouldered his shovel as if to say that if he had to deal with someone else's crap in the barnyard, it should at least be the physical rather than the metaphorical kind.
Don't believe me? Okay, I'll prove it to you.
The pixie hawked up a loogie and spat it at his feet.
I've got more magic juice than a poisoned apple orchard and jump spittle. That's an ordinary goat over there, right?
Staff pointed at Gus. He's kind of annoying, but otherwise, yeah.
Watch this.
Staff glared at the goat and thrust out a hand in a claw gesture. The billy goat rocked back as if struck and began to choke and spit, its yellow eyes rolling back in its head. The pixie produced a tiny wand and added some extra oomph to whatever she was doing, and the goat fell over. Worsley dropped the shovel.
Hey, what are you doing to Gus? Stop it! Already done,
Staff said as she lowered her hands and put the wand away. Kneeling by the fallen and unbreathing Billy, Worsley was unsure how to give mouth-to-mouth to someone with such thin, filthy lips, full of such snuggled yellow teeth. Fortunately, Gus's round belly puffed up with air, and he rolled over and onto his calloused knees, coughing.
You okay, Gus? Come on, buddy. If you're dead, Mom will kill me. Or, actually, that might save me a step.
My name,
said the goat, newly gifted with speech,
is Gustav, not Gus. Get it straight, Pooh Boy.
His voice was more cultured than Worsley's and filled the boy with rage that only made him sound more the bumpkin.
What did you...
That's your name, genius. Pooh Boy. As in the boy who scoops up my poo.
Worsley bristled and said,
That's so juvenile. You...
But Staff cut him off before he could finish.
Look, will you forget the goat and listen to me now? He's not important, but I'm for real, and I'm telling you that you're the chosen one. You have a special destiny. You're gonna do great things.
Why me? Hey, it wasn't me that chose you, okay? I just got sent here to do the deed. If I'm gonna choose a hero, you can be darn sure it's not gonna be some whiny, pathetic punk named Pooh Boy. That's not my name, it's Worsley. Whatever. Like that's any better. Anyway, you're hereby anointed. So get to it, will you?
Get to what?
Saving the world.
Or changing it. Or both.
The aura kinda takes care of everything, and it's not my problem anymore. All's I need is a drink and the occasional night of debauchery at the local halfling bar, and I'm good. But you're not good, right? You're a pool boy named Worstly, living in the most wretched earldom in Pell. Time to move on, don't you think? Find your destiny? Get some songs written about you?
do something worth singing about?
Staff turned to go, and Worsley yelped and reached out a hand, although he chickened out of actually touching her. They were short on soap around the farm, after all.
Wait, that's it? I mean, what have I been chosen to do? Gadzooks, boy!
Or zounds.
I don't know which is more appropriate in this case, and I get them mixed up.
Me too,
Worsley admitted.
But I do know one thing. You gotta figure out your destiny your own dang self.
But I'm really new to all this. Don't you have a suggestion about where to begin?
The pixie shrugged, scratched idly at her belly, and pointed vaguely to the southeast.
If you amble along that way a while in the road to Tenebris, you'll come across the Earl's Tower. His castle, too, but the tower's the thing.
So?
Staff blew out a frustrated sigh.
So, people don't go to the trouble of building a tower unless they want to protect something they think is valuable inside it. Odds are you'll find some treasure in there. Either that or the patriarchal son of a nun is trying to protect the virtue of his daughter. She'll probably be clean and boring, in which case I bet you'll take a shine to her. Go thou, verily, forsooth, swear by your troth, or something. Well, just do your chores here in the muck for the rest of your life. Doesn't tweak my tuppence either way. I'm done here.
She turned her back on Worsley, blasted him with a powerful, if squeaky, fart, giggled, and flew away in an unsteady, looping trajectory, leaving a trail of dull glitter in her wake.
Wow! Did that just happen?
Worsley gagged, trying to wave away the pixie's parting gift.
Sure did, the billy goat said. Say, why don't you begin your quest to change the world by giving me something good to eat for a change? Go in the house and fetch your father's boots. They smell delicious.
At the sound of the goat's voice, Worsley whipped his head around so fast that he heard something pop in his neck.
Go! So, I wasn't imagining it. You really can talk now.
Boots, Pooh Boy. Now, read my lips.
Your lips don't match your words very well.
Goat lips are different, aren't they? Now hurry up.
Worsley wasn't about to argue with a goat.
No, wait, he totally was.
Forget that noise. You heard Staff. I'm the chosen one. That means I'm done with this barnyard. Done with you. Done with this life. I'm gonna go to that tower and things are gonna be better. I'll be able to go up to the baker in town and ask for a slice of real cake. The fancy kind. With frosting and no mold.
Gustav snorted.
You really ought to think that one through, okay? You have trouble defending yourself against me and a couple of geese. You have no weapons and no armor. You're like, what, 90 pounds? World out there is gonna crush you.
Nah, it'll all work out. I was chosen. I have a destiny. You'll see.
No, I really won't. I'm staying right here, where it's safe.
Okay, stay, if you want. But my parents are planning to eat you in a couple weeks. Mom won't shut up about all the curry recipes.
Gustav stared at Worsley so long that the farm boy thought the goat had lost the ability to talk.
You know what?
The goat finally said.
I'm tired of this barnyard, too. Can't remember the last time I saw a she-goat. Maybe they're all in that tower we're supposed to go find. An entire tower of goatly delight. Sweet nannies galore!
Yeah! Let's go! I just need to pack a few things.
Don't forget your father's boots.
Worsley's parents, unfortunately, were less than understanding about his announcement that he was off to seek his fortune as the chosen one, anointed by Staff, the pixie. A bit of flailing and wrestling ensued as they tried to lock him up in the root cellar for his own good, but when Gustav intervened and told them to let him go, they tried instead to set the goat aflame.
"Evil magic!" his mother shrieked. "Evil in our home! Kill it with fire!"
Worsley's father led him out of a chokehold and dashed to the hearth, fetching out a burning branch.
"Get thee gone, demon!"
the decrepit and toothless 32-year-old man shouted, waving his torch.
"Y'all are intense,"
Gustav said, backing out of the door and dropping a batch of emergency plops in self-defense. Worsley's father followed, and then came Worsley himself, all gangly limbs and wild eyes, clutching a loaf of bread and a jar of pickled herring. The goat and the boy quickly outpaced their elders down the road toward the village.
"That's all you got?"
Gustav said, eyeing Worsley's bundles and trying very hard to frown, but lacking the proper facial musculature.
"I just grabbed what I could on the way out the door."
"You could have gotten the boots."
"He was wearing them, and he wanted to burn you alive."
"That's no excuse. You just had your arse anointed by an honest-to-God's pixie. You ought to have better luck than this."
"Well, I'm sure we'll do better in town. Look at the sky. The clouds are parting for once. It's an omen, Gus."
"Or it's just weather. And again, the name is Gustav."
"Fine, Gustav it is. But I think you're both right and wrong. You're right that I should have better luck, and I will when there's something I truly need. I don't need my father's boots."
"Yes, you do. You need to give them to me."
"No, I don't. I need to go to that tower and score the first notch in my hero's belt. And once I've got that experience, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to find Lord Urgot and make him pay for killing Bestley, because a chosen one sets things right."
"I thought a chosen one just leaves a trail of blood and chaos behind him."
"What do you know about it? You're a goat. You're wrong about that, and wrong about the weather, too, which is what I meant to say before you interrupted me. That break in the clouds is an omen.
Of justice!
Of light beating back the darkness! Of the dawn of the age of Worsley! Does that not sound noble?"
"It sounds like an era of shame and incontinence,"
Worsley scoffed.
"You have no ear for poetry."
"Maybe not, but I have an ear for nonsense."
"I was chosen. Wait and see."
"I don't have to wait to see that you're putting too much faith in a drunken pixie."
"Wrong again."
But Gustav was right, about the weather, at least. It soon began raining in a very non-magical style. There were no rainbows, no leprechauns, and after a few brief moments, no gleaming sun parting the clouds. Just a boy and his goat taking their first muddy steps toward a moist, squelching destiny. 3. In the Tower of Toby, the Dark Lord, he who dreams of artisanal crackers. The Dark Lord took a break from studying the esoteric movements of the magical spheres of portent and went to the cupboard for some crackers.
Lo, he found none, and he was very angry.
"Dementria! Where are the godzooks or the crackers?"
he shouted into the night, and then wondered if he should have said zounds instead. When no answer wafted his way, he glared at the hourglass, forgetting when last he'd turned it. It was probably past 6, and his wizened servant had already departed for the night.
"The world is a terrible place,"
Toby said to a hedgehog squatting sadly in a cage on the table.
"What's
the point of being a potentially all-powerful wizard if you can't even have cheese and crackers when you really, really deserve them? The hedgehog merely tightened into a bristly ball and said nothing, seeing as how staff had not visited and bestowed the gift of speech upon it. Even if she had, the hedgehog mostly would have whimpered, having been the subject of Toby's wizardly attentions all day. And then the hedgehog would have uncurled, poked a tiny finger in the wizard's chest, and explained that hedgehogs and box turtles couldn't mate. And even if they could, shoving them at one another and shouting at them for hours wasn't exactly considered seductive. The turtle, for his part, was playing dead, and rather convincingly. The hedgehog liked the turtle better that way, but she still had a boyfriend back home in the garden and wasn't interested.
"I am the all-powerful Dark Lord, and I will have crackers!"
Toby shouted, green bolts of magic issuing from his fingertips and leaping to a nearby platter, where something almost exactly like crackers appeared in an artistic sort of arrangement. Unfortunately, one of the green bolts also hit the cage, and its energy traveled all along the metal and wound up shocking the nethers of its occupants. The hedgehog squeaked in anger. That was not the way to turn anyone on. The turtle, for his part, just crackled a bit. Turning away from his recalcitrant captives, Toby fetched a wheel of cheese from his magical cabinet and began paring off slivers to eat with his almost crackers.
"If you two would just breed like reasonable creatures," he said to the hedgehog, "I'd have the magical familiar I require to fully access my abilities, and then I could conjure real crackers, the kind with seeds placed on them by artisans. Or maybe the seeds were grown by artisans regardless. They'd be artisanal. Because I'd have an armored, spiny, talking turtle hog familiar, and my magic would be boundless, and I could lure the finest cheesemongers to my very door. No more ordering from catalogs."
He took a bite of cheese and pseudo-cracker and munched thoughtfully, almost crumbs peppering his almost beard. He stroked it. What few pathetic hairs there were, and his spirit sank. If only he had a beard. He wouldn't need the turtle hog. He would already have the magic he desired, and he'd be able to summon true crackers from the ether, and a lot more. Darkness, storm clouds, storks! But he had to admit, at his ripening age, that such a beard would never be his, unless he managed to stumble across a particularly hirsute dwarf corpse while holding a very sharp knife in an area with little foot traffic. There were many such ways to become a true wizard if one was born with the knack, but they all depended on something random, dangerous, or impossible. Among them, connect with a mystical animal that agreed to be your familiar.
Grow a stupendously long beard.
Find a crystal wand, be blessed by a pixie, fall into a vat of glowing green spiders, or climb a beanstalk and steal a golden goose. Thus far, Lord Toby had utterly failed to secure the means to really pump up his power and make his dreams come true. He'd never left this little corner of Pell, as he'd heard the ill-kept roads were chock-full of highwaymen and unsavory halflings. Even his decently fat purse wasn't enough to secure a true crystal wand, and so he'd spent years trying to breed strange animals while hunting for beard oils and unguents to encourage follicle growth. But it was all for naught. His oily little goatee would barely look respectable on a billy goat, and he hated billy goats, except to eat. It might be time, he thought, to figure out some other career. His father, the elder Toby, a true Dark Lord with a luxurious beard, had died in a freak pitchfork accident, cutting short a life of macabre magnificence. And Toby was now that same age, and had accomplished not nearly half so much. All his life Toby had longed to follow in his father's dread footsteps, save for the last one on the pitchfork. But until his magical powers were secured, he couldn't print Dark Lord on his stationery without summoning the wrath of the Council of Merlins. Privately calling himself the Dark Lord, however, Well, that would be hard to give up. He might have to grow accustomed to being merely an ominous adept. And perhaps he needed a convertible carriage with a bespoke leather interior to distract him from this disappointment. Just then a sonorous bell rang, echoing around and up the jet-black stones of the Dark Lord's tower. Toby perked up, straightening his robes and smoothing the crumbs from the embroidered stars on his velvet lapels.
Ah,
he said, drawing himself up tall and looking very wise.
'Tis the mail.
Ignoring the traumatized creatures in the cage, he clambered down the stairs of his tower, noting that towers were really a very stupid kind of building, as they required 3 times as many steps as anything else. And one day, if all went well, he would be a white-bearded wizard, and fall down and down and around and break his back and die in a puddle of wizard blood. This time, at least, he made it down all 613 steps to throw open the carved oaken doors to reveal neat rows of roses and hedges and a very angry male hedgehog and an unwelcome mat.
Who dares disturb the mite?
But the mail carrier was long gone, considering it had taken Toby nearly half an hour to navigate his own home. There on the step, he found a packet of missives filled with dark tidings, including several bills and foul solicitations for charity. One letter stood out, and he slit the wax seal with a particularly creepy pinky nail he'd grown out long for just such an occasion.
"Dear Sir or Madam," it began, "dost thou have the power to kill thine enemies? For I need just such a wizard."
Toby brightened considerably, pleased that word of his powers, or almost powers, had spread. But when he read, "Payment shall be in chickens," he ripped the letter in half and set it on fire with a candle guttering in a sconce in his foyer. He hated chickens. The ones in his barnyard were exceptionally awful. They wouldn't breed with hedgehogs either. The only worse payment than chickens was exposure. And Toby didn't like to talk about his seamy past in the Lordling of the Month calendars. The last letter seemed rather promising, being heavy in the sort of way that indicated it might contain actual currency. But Toby quickly noted that it was addressed to someone else, a Grinda the Good Witch, who lived at Malefic Beach, whereas Toby lived at Malefic Reach. It was a simple enough mistake. Weighing the bundle in his hand, Toby stroked what little beard he had.
"The Dark Lord does what he will," he finally said,
and there was no one around to suggest that perhaps the Dark Lord shouldn't open someone else's mail. Unfortunately, the letter's weight wasn't owing to a bundle of writs or deeds, or the secret recipe for Glandalf's great goatee-growing grease, no. The envelope, in fact, held the most horrific thing the Dark Lord could imagine, a very detailed letter of woe.
"My dear Sister Grinda," it began, "woe unto us, for worstly hath runneth Orfith. He is our last remaining son, and who shall now clean up the dung?"
Normally, Toby would have stopped reading immediately, but something caught his eye in the next sentence.
"He hath told us he is the chosen one, and taken with him our last fine goat, which is truly an evil creature, as it hath beginneth talking and spraying mine floor with panic shite."
Mesmerized, Toby read on, wincing at the horrible grammar and utter abuse of capital letters and extra E's. After several pages of ranting and bemoaning her many recipes for goat stew that would never be used, and the loss of an important bottle of fish, he had learned one fact that now overshadowed even his need for crackers and a proper turtle hog empire. The boy, worstly, had been designated the chosen one. Toby was very familiar with Staff the Pixie and her proclamations. It was she who had first suggested that he
go home to grow his beard and fiddle with his pillar,
which was obviously a reference to his future as a wizard living in a properly terrifying tower. He had followed her suggestion immediately,
and he still wasn't done fiddling with his tower. He had many improvements to make, in fact, and assumed he'd be fiddling with his tower and grooming the shrubbery around it until he was a doddering old man and his tower was falling down. Staff, for all her unpleasantness, was never wrong. And that meant there was a chosen one. And one of the many unusual ways to become a fully puissant wizard involved possessing the heart of a chosen one. It seemed like a ghastly way to breed magic, but Toby wasn't complaining. After all, there were other benefits to killing a chosen one, so he'd be doing a public service. For one thing, chosen ones were very bad for business. One couldn't have them mucking about, seeking their destinies and screwing up everything for the hard-working folk who didn't think they were the center of the world. Whether or not they succeeded on their quests, chosen ones upset the status quo. And Toby, the Dark Lord, was rather happy with the status quo at the moment. Maybe not as related to crackers, hedgehogs, and turtles, but when it came to the current political climate, the common man was prospering. On one side of Toby's tower, the King of Pell was a silly, unambitious man who paid more attention to liquor and horses than his actual kingdom. And on the other side, the fatuous Earl of Borix was resting, as it were, under a sleeping spell.
Lord Urgot of Brooding was mostly running things while the Earl was napping, and Lord Urgot was quite easily bribed when one needed a wee favor, at least in regards to building codes and tower improvements.
Peace and quiet and magic. That was what a Dark Lord wanted. Or quiet and magic in a thriving market for crossbred animals. Get a bunch of chosen ones running about unchecked, and one of the lot was certain to start gunning for the darkest lord around, assuming he had all sorts of terrible plans to call forth demons from the underworld and steal princesses, and honestly, that was just a lot of work. Toby was quite content. And that meant he now had one goal. Kill the farm boy. For the general economy, of course, for the good of the people. And if the chosen one's heart should disappear, most likely no one would notice. They'd be too busy cheering to have the wicked little busybody safely out of the way.
Poultry!
Toby shouted, stepping carefully over his unwelcome mat to glower in the direction of his barn. Part of the Dark Lord's contentment stemmed from a tidy insurance settlement. They paid double for pitchfork accidents that had financed many improvements in his domain, as well as a few servants bound to his land. Dementria went home at night to soak her bunions, but his own unchosen farm boy shared the hayloft with his sister, Poltro. The girl appeared now, cutting a charming figure as she leapt from the barn's double doors. Her livery was all black, her sword and dagger hanging at her side as her cloak swept dramatically behind her. Her hair, dark as a raven's wing, rippled back from an olive brow, her eyes as sharp as an eagle's. Toby had paid handsomely to have her fostered to a huntsman named Cutter, and as he watched her approach, he felt that his money had been well spent. Right up until she tripped over a chicken and fell on her face in the muck.
Corp!
She muttered, sitting up on her knees to wipe chicken dung from her lips.
I bloody hate chickens. Stealthy things they are.
Toby's fingers twitched, but he used his hard-won control to firm them up into a fist.
Poltro, I have a job for you,
he said, sounding mysterious and magnanimous. She stood, wobbling and trying to wipe the various stains from her costume.
Oh, but it ain't chickens, she said. Never trust them, what with their pokey beaks and their butt fruit. I'll tell you, sire, it's unnatural.
Eggs is.
She cocked an eyebrow.
But if it's eggs, you won't. I'll have a sauce.
Her eyes slid over to a chicken coop.
You didn't hear it from me. But I find a bucket of eggs by the hen house every morning. I do suspect foul play.
Toby swallowed hard and counted to 10. Between her brother and Poltro, Poltro was still the better bet, and the job he had for her was a tricky, delicate thing. He beckoned her closer, and Poltro managed to make it across the yard without tripping on another chicken, although she did have quite a standoff with a sheep.
Finally, she stood before him, cloak thrown back to undulate in the wind.
"What is your will, my lord?"
she asked. She meant to kneel in respect, but misjudged the distance and ended up with her face just a little too close to Toby's crotch. He cleared his throat and backed away.
"My huntsman, I command you to find the Chosen One. Take his life, and bring me his still-beating heart,"
he said, sounding just as grand as he imagined he would. In the silence afterward, a few chickens clucked, and the one Poltro had fallen on sort of fluttered to indicate it was trying.
"A fine errand for a Tuesday, my lord, but just so there's no misunderstanding, do you mean, like, kill him and then bring you his heart? Because I was fairly certain that when you killed someone, their heart stopped beating." "Cutter led me to believe it was a sort of cause and effect thing and no way around it. So I feel like I could bring you his not beating heart. Or maybe I could, like, tie him up and bring him and then kill him in front of you and you'd know his heart was still beating right up until he died."
Toby considered that and was frustrated by how much sense it made. When Poltro started talking sense, it usually meant one had drunk too much.
"Fair enough. I then command that you kill the Chosen One and bring me his heart. Not beating, but if it was, that would be okay too."
"But it won't be,"
she argued.
"Fine, just the heart."
"Why his heart, my lord? Could a kidney work? Or maybe a lymph node?"
Toby barely stopped himself from spluttering.
"Because, well, I need to know he's dead."
"Oh,
so my word isn't good enough for you. I tell you someone's dead and you would doubt that? My lord, I find your lack of confidence very insulting."
Toby's fingers spasmed and his voice cracked, but he most certainly did not shoot green lightning at Poltro, because even if she was terribly clumsy and rather annoying, she was an excellent and effective tracker who would soon have this Chosen One in hand, as long as he wasn't a chicken.
"A Chosen One,"
he said slowly,
"is a very tricky thing, my dear. I will need his heart for..."
He almost said personal reasons, but realized that sounded a bit creepy.
"Magical reasons,"
he finished, but afterward realized that sounded equally stupid.
"Magical reasons,"
Poltro repeated.
"Well, can't argue with magic. What can you tell me of this Chosen One, my lord?"
Toby squinted at the sheaf of papers in his other hand, trying to remember the pertinent details drawn from the pages and pages of purple prose he'd read.
"His name is Worstly. He smells of dung. He's traveling with a black goat that may or may not talk. Worstly is 18, white as milk and tall and strong, with wavy blonde hair and earnest blue eyes that sparkle with a call to greatness."
He paused to wrinkle his nose.
"Gadzooks, who writes this trash? He was last seen in a jerkin and breeches the color of mud and smeared with barnyard waste, with a cloak to match. Headed out with a jar of pickled herring to save the world while breaking his poor parents' hearts. Honestly, he sounds terrible."
"He sounds like every other lad about the countryside. Pickled herring is right popular for good reason. But the talking goat might give me an edge,"
Poltro mused.
"Where will I find him?" "The return address suggests he lives somewhere to the west. So I suppose this tower he's headed toward is the Earl's, the one all covered in thorns and whatnot. Only a Chosen One would be foolish enough to try to penetrate that wily thatch."
Poltro rose to her feet and struck a proud pose, with one boot pointed.
"Head toward the tower entangled in a wily thatch. Find the Chosen One and kill him. Got it?"
She took a few stalwart steps, then turned back around.
"What about the goat?"
Toby shook his head.
What about the goat?
Do you want his heart too? And if so,
can I eat the rest of it?
And if so, will you be wanting some? I mean, how are we going to divide this guy's girlfriend? And how do you feel about curry?
Rubbing the place where a headache was brewing, Toby said,
You may keep whatever parts of the goat you wish. I just want this farm boy's heart.
So the rest of him is up for grabs?
The rest of the goat?
No, the rest of the... The goat. Good eating, goat!
With that, she saluted him with the wrong hand and set off toward the west. Toby watched her go, feeling a lightness in his heart as the huntress hopped over the fence and landed on her face. As she stalked into the sunset, he called after her,
Poultry!
From far away, she turned, cape billowing in the early evening wind.
Yes, Dark Lord!
Did you want to take your horse?
She shouted a very rude word and jogged back toward the barn to saddle her coal-black steed. Toby waited, watching his chickens and sheep, all black as night, peck at the ground. When Poltro finally rode out of the barn, her stallion prancing, the Dark Lord walked up to her and held out a small bag he'd untied from his belt.
What's this, my lord? Provisions?
No, Poltro. You can take your own provisions from the larder in your quarters. These are a few potions to aid you on your journey. They are carefully labelled and sealed with wax. One is an invisibility potion that will hide you from any enemy. One is a sleeping potion. Taken in its entirety, the victim will sleep for a year. And the third is a healing elixir that will heal any wound or sickness.
He didn't mention it, but he'd purchased them through a mail-order potion purveyor and was too frightened to use them himself. Poltro took the bag and peered inside as her horse snorted and danced.
How do they work?
Read the labels.
But do I drink them, or do they go...
She made a poking motion with one finger.
Up the other way. Your mum used to give us one like that.
Read the labels. None of them are to be taken rectally.
Good,
she said, nodding and tying the bag onto her belt.
Anything else, my lord?
Just kill the farm boy, Poltro, and bring me his heart. When you return, you will be well rewarded. What will you claim as your bounty?
Her chin raised as she looked off into the sunset. A fierce creature with eyes always on the horizon.
A world without chickens,
she breathed.
I could probably build you a lean-to in the south pasture, he said, but you'll have to keep the chickens out yourself.
Such is my fate. Onward, snowflake!
Digging her heels into the black stallion's ribs, she took off at a mad gallop before stopping short at the gate, dismounting, fumbling with the latch, opening the gate, remounting, riding through the gate, dismounting, closing the gate, catching her horse after he wandered off to crop grass, and remounting. With another ferocious war cry, she kicked the horse again and galloped off into the outer reaches of his estate, completely forgetting to take any provisions. There were three more gates to navigate before the road, which required an obscene amount of mounting of both the re and dis varieties. Toby gave up and began the long climb upstairs. For just a moment he considered going after the Chosen One himself, but he'd never left his tower before, and the papers and best-selling books he ordered seemed to suggest that life happened on the other side of the doorstep, and that said life generally involved a lot of getting robbed and killed. One of the lovely things about being the Dark Lord was that one could choose to stay at home, masterminding various dark deeds from the comfort of one's own armchair, even if one always felt a bit left out and couldn't quite manage the right sort of crackers. Home had been good enough for his father, and home would be good enough for Toby. The Chosen One was, for the moment, out of his hands. But maybe the hedgehog could still be coaxed. 4. At a time and place
where a goat proves to be remarkably prescient. One of the many downsides to chainmail bikinis, Fia thought, was their utter uselessness as protective gear against a tower of thorns. To be sure, they were utterly useless as protective gear against most things, including inclement weather, and this blasted, gloomy northern province had been rainy and cold for days. Her skin had developed long-standing goosebumps the size of angry pimples. But her purse was more than unusually light, as she'd put down a significant sum with a blacksmith for some real armor, and whatever she found in this tower was going to pay off the balance of it. Fia had recently ventured north and west from the warm eastern lands to seek her fortune, and her dark brown skin, impressive height, and ability to pound xenophobes to pulp had already become legendary. She'd even gotten a hot tip from a shady halfling in the capital that most everyone inside this castle was asleep. It was ripe for the picking. Fia had challenged him on that point.
"If it's so ripe, why hasn't it been picked already by someone else?"
The halfling ordered another pint on her tab before answering, but he didn't dodge the question. He leaned over the table at the inn, his foul breath making Fia curl her lip in disgust, and for the first time that evening, looked her in the eye.
"I'll walk you through it, my tall drink of mead. Most people do not appreciate the extent to which thorns truly suck. If you have just a single rose bush to deal with, then they're no big deal. You just go around, right? But the entire tower is covered in thick vines. Heck, the entire castle is, and each vine bristles with thorns that can only be described as deluxe, and you have to climb the tower to gain access through a window. The door is impregnable. Invisible, actually. No one can find it."
Ignoring the paradox of an architect who forgot to include such essentials as doors in his designs, Fia adjusted her chainmail wedgie and said,
"I don't see the problem. Bushes and vines are flammable." "True enough. That's no lie. But if you start a fire, you're asking for other trouble. You lose all hope of stealth, for one thing. You might wind up burning down the stuff inside you want to steal. And besides that, fire always brings the neighbors outdoors to see if they can help put it out. You don't want witnesses now, do you? And there's evidence that not everything sleeps inside that tower. There's someone or something most certainly, definitely, indubitably awake in there, and whoever or whatever it is, they are not afraid to sing horrible songs."
Fia scoffed.
"What do I care about songs?"
The halfling grinned.
"Oh, these are no mere ditties. The melodies are laced with magic of a most powerful and potent nature. And the singer of said songs never sleeps. We have confirmed this through long observation." "Why don't you just fly to the window on one of those giant eagles, or a dragon?"
The halfling's casual amusement vanished, and his voice grew intense.
"Do you have access to any creatures willing to perform such services? Because if you do, I assure you, we would pay well for an introduction."
"Who's we?"
The halfling waved the question away.
"A consortium of like-minded individuals."
He looked pleased with himself, as if he'd just learned the word consortium the day before and had been waiting for an opportunity to use it.
"Well, no, I don't know any flying creatures. Sorry."
The halfling deflated, and his eyes drifted down from her face and toward the tiny triangles of her top, perhaps in an effort to cheer himself up. Fia resolutely ignored this, adding,
"And I guess you don't know any either. But how about a ladder?"
The halfling picked up his pint, which was nearly the size of his head, and answered with the cup to his lips, making his voice ring hollow.
"We've tried that. 3 times. We sent out teams with ladders, ropes and grappling hooks too, before you ask. Real quality stuff. None returned. As I said, these are truly deluxe thorns.
Well, Fia had listened to that halfling, and she had taken what he said to heart. She now wore a pair of rose-repelling metal gauntlets as she stood right at the base of the aforementioned tower, in the middle of a ferocious and properly dramatic downpour. The halfling had been willing to lend these so-called deluxe gauntlets to her for an outrageous 40% of whatever she got out of the tower. He'd first demanded 80%, but she pointed out that she'd generously allowed him to stare at her chest all night without smashing his brains into pudding, and that should be worth something. To protect her feet, she had wrapped up the soles of her boots in belts of the toughest leather she could find. Now she just had to get past the deluxe thorns in the cold rain while still mostly naked. No big deal, she told herself. Although, up close, these particular thorns seemed a step up from your average rose thorns, in the way that a rabid wolfhound seemed a step up from a pug. The halfling, against his better nature, had been telling the truth. The vines had been growing for so long and had wrapped themselves so tightly around the tower that they could serve as a natural ladder, providing a convenient way to climb up. Convenient, that is, apart from the thorns. Because there were many smaller, thinner vines flourishing and flowering on top of the thick, trunk-like ones, forming a dense thicket of doom. A tricky tangle, Fia thought, for she'd have to reach in there with clever fingers, a most wily thatch concealing the tender flower she so desired. And to think, she was doing all this for a single rose. As it turned out, the two things Fia most wanted in the world were armor and peace. If everything went according to plan, the heart rose of this enchanted tower would give her both, thanks to a generous prize to be awarded at the celebrated Pell Smells Rose Show. With a heavily perfumed bag of gold in hand, she'd be unstoppable. Or more stoppable, actually, as she would finally be able to stop fighting and settle down. A prize-winning rose garden in a quiet hamlet where nobody knew her past, and the ability to defend said garden from anyone who wanted to take it from her, that was Fia's idea of earthly paradise. But first, she had to get inside. She noted a small collection of rusty hatchets at the base of the tower, not stacked neatly. They looked as if they'd fallen there randomly from the sky, although even in this strange place, it didn't generally rain basic lumberjack supplies. A few frogs here or there, but such was weather. Fia had brought a hatchet, too, expecting to clear away some of the branches, but now she reconsidered, thinking of the halfling teams that had never returned, and noting that there were also a few assorted bones mixed in with the hatchets, as well as some rotting pieces of wood that had no doubt at one time formed a ladder. Squinting up through the rain, she saw scraps of blue and yellow cloth snagged upon some of the vines, along with a sprinkling of tarnished metal medallions. And there were pale flashes of white caught in the boscage, which proved to be the latticed ribcages of other thieves, forever imprisoned in verdigris and roses. That was not merely gruesome, it was strange.
If they died while trying to climb up, Fia mused, as she often talked out her problems, they'd have to fall, especially if they were on ladders. There's no way a few thorns can hold up that much dead weight. I should be seeing full skeletons down here. So that means the vines had to overgrow them while they were still alive, trapping them. Hells! That'd have to be a quick-growing bush. But it's not growing now, is it?
It most certainly was not. At least not visibly so. That meant that something had triggered the rapid and clearly fatal growth. And that something was probably the collection of hatchets at the base of the tower. Hack at the magical vines and they would quickly respond with a thorny embrace, hugging you close until something vital was pierced or you simply bled to death.
Hugs shouldn't hurt, mighty Fia thought, much less kill you.
Fia added her hatchet to the pile but kept her sword lashed to her back in its leather scabbard. She also had some pocket shears hanging from a belt in case things got snippy. Reaching out one steel gauntlet toward the thicket, she laid hold of a thick rope of vine and heard the dull click of a thorn snapping beneath her hand. She paused, grimacing, waiting for the vine to strike like a snake. But the vine just did what normal vines do, which is not much. And that was good. She looked down, seeing that there was still a smidgen of space between her body and the mass of thorns.
Such was the benefit of being 7 feet tall with an impressive reach, and such was the supportive power of chainmail. She grinned in the rain and took a deep breath of the rosewater air. The blossoms beyond the vines must truly be remarkable. Fia had neglected to tell the halfling that she wasn't there for gold or kisses or the usual booty. No, all Fia wanted was that heart rose. With her large green thumb, she could create a hybrid that didn't want to murder everyone, but still promised bright blooms and strong stems. Unfortunately, a small clipping from the tangle simply wouldn't do. No, she needed the heart rose, which was almost